Our next case for this morning is First State Bank of Monticello against Ohio Casualty Insurance Company. Mr. Schoenberger.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Chip Schoenberger, representing Ohio Casualty. Your Honors, this case involves a standard form, coverage under a standard form financial institution bond. And just by way of background, these bonds are designed to insure against, ironically, Your Honor's example in the first case, things like robbery in a bank, other concealed frauds and dishonest acts, things that the bank has no reasonable way of anticipating or protecting against.
Let me ask you this question then. Ordinarily, of course, when somebody shows up at a bank counter with a conventional check, you know, let's say made out for $1,000, they present the check. The exchange that you're talking about, you know, money for the check or a money order, you know, some money equivalent for the check, is given, and you assume that the check is probably negotiable. Maybe there's some, you know, you know what your risk of non-collection is, but there's, if you will, an ordinary risk of non-collection. But if the person showing up at the counter, like Mr. Stillwell, is just flat-out lying, effectively, when he presents the check. He presents the check, my hypothetical check, for $1,000, knowing perfectly well that there's not a penny to cover it in his bank account. Why wouldn't that count as the kind of false pretenses that this bond is designed to cover?
Well, I think, first of all, that kind of a transaction that you're describing, the bank has policies in place that prevent that from happening. What you do is you either say, we'd be happy to enter into the transaction, give us the check, we'll hold it, we'll wait till it clears, we'll issue you your certified funds. To circumvent a policy that is designed to prevent a loss in that situation creates a risk that the bank knows about when it enters into that transaction. A personal check, an uncertified personal check, is not guaranteed. There is a substantial risk of non-collection if you are going to just grant instant credit, essentially, for the amount on that check.
So you think this all has to do with the cost of precautions the bank is able to take? I mean, I suppose there are some precautions you can take against forgeries as well. There are some precautions that you can take against all manner of things that are, in fact, covered by the bond. It's just that they're really expensive, and so we don't expect banks to do them in the ordinary course of business.
Certainly, to detect a forgery takes a lot more effort. To hold on to a personal check drawn on a bank, on another bank, from a customer who doesn't even have a depository account in your bank, to simply put in place a policy that says either we don't do this, or if we do, we hold on to the check until the funds clear. It's a very simple procedure. It doesn't cost anything extra.
But the problem is the insuring agreement in question here, B1 in the bond, isn't subject to the sort of limitation that you're putting forward as the core of your argument here. It doesn't have that kind of a limitation. It just says we're going to cover this sort of a loss, on-premises fraud. It doesn't say anything about the bank having or not having systems in place to detect fraud.
It doesn't say that directly in the language, but what it does say, and this is the heart of the case, is the causation language under Insuring Agreement B, which says resulting directly from. Now, that's the RBC case, and that is that a resulting directly from means a direct cause, and the direct cause is not any cause that sets into motion a chain of events that ultimately leads to a loss. A direct cause is the immediate, uninterrupted cause by other intervening causes. And in this case, what Stillwell did was he walked in and he said, I have a personal check drawn on another bank. Will you please give me certified funds for it? At that point, the bank had absolute control over the situation. They could have rejected the transaction. They could have held on to the check. They could have required that he get a letter of credit from the bank that the check was drawn on to guarantee that the funds would be good, or at least that the check would be paid and the problem would become Tuscola National's problem. That's the causation element of the insuring agreement.
So the acceptance of any check would be the direct cause, then, right?
The acceptance of any check would be a direct cause. I think if it results in a loss and the acceptance of the check is against bank policy, then the cause is the person who circumvented the policy.
Your bond doesn't say only if following acceptable banking practices or your own policies.
Well, I think that, you know, insurance companies, they write these policies and or these bonds based on their own assessment of risk. There's no way for an insurer to assess the risk if the bank is allowed to circumvent all reasonable banking procedures and just take on these unreasonable risks at will, knowing that the policy is going to cover that. That there's no way to protect the insurance. There's no way the insurance company can assess what risk it's getting into when it insures a bank that engages in those kinds of practices.
But what I want to ask you is, why isn't that argument better conceived as under the exclusions that you're arguing about? It seems to me in this case the immediate cause of this was Stilwell's fraudulent representation in these January transactions, that these were bona fide checks. So, I mean, one issue here is there a loss that would be covered by the language of the bond? And the bond document refers to false pretenses. I don't know what false pretenses would be, if not what Stilwell was doing. Then there's sort of layer two for you is whether, even if it is a loss, is that particular loss one that falls within an exclusion? And that's where you begin to get language in the bond and the insurance agreement that looks more like banking practices language, loss caused by an employee, you know, the exclusion 2H.
Well, certainly the causation issue overlaps both the exclusion and insuring agreement B, but the main difference is, and the important difference is, that under insuring agreement B you have the direct immediate cause language, and then under the exclusion you have this broader caused by an employee language, and that's the language that for instance the Eighth Circuit looked at and said, well, this is really closer to a proximate cause, this is really more any kind of a much more substantial or much broader language that allows for more causes to come in and create this loss.
No, but our circuit has specifically rejected that interpretation of exclusion H in the banker's bond. First National Bank of Manitowoc versus Cincinnati Insurance Company.
That's the recent case from this year.
Right.
That case is a little bit different because that involved a loan and it also involved an argument as to whether or not they could...
It was a forgery case.
The argument was whether or not the bank properly investigated and would have uncovered the forgery. In this case, there was no investigation necessary. You just apply your own policy. Your policy says don't take these checks. I think that case is factually distinguishable. And so, I mean, getting back to exclusion H, which is, like I said, the broader contract language... That allows for the cause of the loss to be interpreted under a proximate cause analysis, and that would include certainly the bank's employees' actions in this case, because without their actions, this transaction never happens. All the tellers knew, everyone in the bank knew, if someone comes in with a check drawn on another account, they're not a depository customer, we have no way of physically holding the funds to guarantee that we're going to get paid, then reject the transaction.
Of what relevance is it that Mr. Stilwell had that mortgage with your client?
That's really
kind of a customer, if not a depository customer.
He's not a depository customer, and that's specifically what the policy says, because a mortgage, he already owes you money.
Secured loan. I mean, I don't know what the value of the equity was, but mortgages are secured.
Certainly they are. We don't know what the value of the property was here, and I don't. I know that there was some proceedings to foreclose on the property. I don't know what happened there, but I think we have to get back to the actual language of the policy, which says depository accounts don't take checks unless the customer has a depository account in the bank that we can instantaneously take the funds out of. That's why you have the policy, because the certified bank money order, according to all the testimony, is the equivalent of cash.
Right.
And so essentially that's our argument as it relates to causation under those two insuring agreements. And then the loss argument, as Your Honor touched upon, is sort of the threshold issue. And I think it's important to note that the insuring agreements, the only one that mentions property is insuring agreement B. And property is defined as a negotiable instrument. All these instruments that are involved, all the checks and the money orders, they're all are enforceable and valid, and they're forms of property under the bond. So really all that happened here was you entered into an essentially a credit transaction to exchange one form of property for another. And there's nothing about the bond that says that those two forms of property have to be proportionate in value or that they have to have collectible assets backing them. I see that my time is running out, so I'll reserve the rest of it.
Fine.
Thank you.
Ms. Litzinger?
May it please the Court. Loss directly resulting from false pretenses. It is the bank's responsibility to establish coverage under insuring agreement B, and the bank has done so based on the record evidence before the trial court.
But, of course, your opponent is, he's not really arguing that there's no link between Mr. Stilwell's false pretenses and the loss. But he's saying that maybe the moment at which it all could have been forestalled is if the bank employee had simply applied the policies that the bank had. I mean, I actually find Mr. Stilwell's story about needing to have cash for accounting reasons so preposterous. It's astounding to me that anybody would have bought it. I mean, if you want to cash a check, you go to the bank where you have the account. You cash the check. You don't run across the street to some other bank and give them a cockamamie story. But in any event, what I think the point here isn't whether Mr. Stilwell had some responsibility. Was it enough responsibility for the loss to bring him to bring this transaction within the bond?
Well, I agree with the Court that the loss is within the bond. The issue really is whether or not exclusion H applies.
Well, I didn't quite say that. I just said if we found that, but if you want to focus on exclusion H, I'd be happy to, because I think that exclusion H, which says this bond does not cover loss caused by an employee except in these various circumstances.
I think we have to go back in time a little bit to understand how this transaction history developed. Beginning in November 18th of 2002, Mr. Stilwell or his representatives came into the bank. They presented checks drawn on the Tuscola National Bank. Now, Mr. Stilwell is a longtime resident of the area. He owns several very visible businesses, and everybody in town knows that he has this large real estate deal going on that would be development contiguous to the Tuscola Outlet Mall. I don't know if you all are familiar with that. So he's well known, and he is a customer of the bank, not a depository customer, but he has a mortgage there. And he tenders a few checks, and the bank issues their money orders.
There's almost $2 million worth of checks, which strikes me as more than a few.
$1.5 million over the course of 62 days, and Tuscola National Bank makes good on every single check. Now, why do they do this? We find this out in the evidence that Lloyd Murphy, who's the president of Tuscola National Bank, is calling Mr. Stilwell once a week because, as the court pointed out, there was a negative balance in the account every day from November 18th until the whole system collapsed on January 22nd.
It's kiting checks, right? I mean, that's
not really. Because he doesn't have a depository account with our bank, which is why it's not a true kite. But the concept is the same.
Close.
And pretty false pretensy. So on this day,
but it doesn't say anything about false pretense. I mean, Section 2H, here's where I come into Section 2H. I remember what happened with the facts, so I don't think we need to review. I know that they paid on a lot of them. I know they don't pay in those 3 days in January. But there is a real risk of what we would call moral hazard if you essentially tell banks, it doesn't matter how careless your employees are, it doesn't matter how negligently they disregard normal banking policies, such as putting a hold for a week on a check before you, for a non-account holder, before you'll pay out cash on it. then banks will have no incentive to be careful. They'll just go to the insurance companies and have the insurance companies cover the kinds of losses that occurred here. The most common thing in the world is to have an ordinary personal check presented and being told that's from a different bank. It's going to be a few days before you have access to the funds. It's a nothing. It's not like trying to dig out fraud or forgery or things that are concealable.
I think, though, if you look at the last 62 days of practice, when he presents the loss checks, which are only 3 days in January, at this point, the bank has two times, First State Bank has twice, sought confirmation of the story. They sought confirmation from Mr. Stilwell. That was confirmed by Lloyd.
I know that they've done that, but I'm getting back to 2H. Why, nonetheless, is this not loss caused by an employee? You would agree that the employee does not follow the letter of the bank's policies.
I would agree with that.
That was what the investigation revealed.
Right.
The entire purpose of these bank policies is to avert precisely this risk. You would agree with that, too, I suspect.
I'm not sure that I would.
That the reason that they don't give cash for non-account holder personal checks is to assure that the checks are collected?
Yes, I'm sorry. I misunderstood, Your Honor.
That's
the time.
Reason the policy's in place. The employee doesn't follow the policy. It turns out they're lucky for $1.5 million worth, and they're not lucky for $307,000 worth.
I think we have to look at the concept of causation, even under Exclusion H, in the context of the Illinois court's decision in RBC. This is a question where whether or not a bond covers a loss is about direct cause.
But it doesn't say that, interestingly, in Exclusion 2H. It does say that in the insurance agreement. And aren't we supposed to pay attention to these differences in language?
Even if we do and the court accepts a proximate cause standard, the last cause of the event, it's sort of like the Parks real estate case that Ohio Casualty cites, where the court's looking at the efficient cause. One cause may set the table for the events that will follow, but the direct physical act that results in the loss, that is the causation for purposes of coverage. In this case, Mr. Stilwell assisted First State Bank in setting the table over the 62-period day of time.
Well, still, I think, reading extra words into 2H. Loss caused by an employee. You're agreeing that it's a proximate cause.
I don't agree that it's a proximate cause. The Ohio Casualty has not identified a single case in which proximate cause was examined under an Exclusion H, in any persuasive manner. The case that they relied upon, Empire Bank, is a situation where the bank officer knew, had actual knowledge, that the customers were engaged in unlawful conduct, forgery and mismanagement of corporate assets, knew and acquiesced. There are no facts in this record to indicate that anyone at First State Bank had actual knowledge that Mr. Stilwell was engaged in bad conduct.
Well, it looks like a negligence case to me. I mean, she's negligent. I don't know if she's grossly negligent or whether she's just negligent, but she's negligent by not following the bank's policies.
If we accept, for purposes of argument, that she didn't follow the policies, which we do, then we have to ask why we're allowing the bank's internal policies to define the standard of care. Because they're not.
This bond does not cover loss caused by an employee.
Right. It doesn't say by violating bank policy. Under Illinois law, a bank's internal policies do not establish a standard of care for any entity outside the bank. We've cited cases to that effect.
It doesn't negate causation, does it? What if she followed bank policies to the letter and her actions still caused the loss? Are you saying that the bond still covers the loss?
Yes, of course. Because if the question is...
Oh, but maybe I didn't say that right. The bond doesn't cover loss caused by an employee. Part A, the loss caused by an employee was a result of failing to follow bank policies, like this case. Part B, the loss caused by an employee happened even though the employee did try to follow and did succeed in following bank policies. Either way, doesn't the exclusion apply?
Except that that's not what our policy says. That's not what the bond says.
The bond says this bond does not cover loss caused by an employee.
Right. Well, if you're looking at causation to define the cause of the event, if we're saying the reason is because she violated the policy, we've accepted causation based on the standard of care articulated in the bank's policies, which is not, in fact, appropriate under Illinois law.
What standard of care do you think applies? Banks can be negligent. Banks can just say, we give money to anybody who walks in, and when it doesn't work out, we'll go to Ohio Casualty.
I think that's far more broad than I intend to present to the court.
Okay.
I'm suggesting
so
that
where's your standard coming from?
My line in the sand here is that when Mr. Stillwell's representatives walk into the bank on those 3 days, they are the last effective cause of why the bank loses that money.
Why isn't her handing the money order across the counter the last cause?
It's his false representation upon which she's relying.
And now you're on part one, and I'm assuming we agree with you on part one. Why isn't her, for Section 2H, her act of handing the money order across the counter the last reason? She's the one that actually takes the money from the bank and gives it away.
I actually think a teller may have been responsible for that, but nevertheless.
A bank person.
A bank employee.
Right.
I have not reserved any time for rebuttal.
No, because you're the right. If you would like to address your cross-appeal for a minute, that would be fine.
I would be happy to do that. In our cross-appeal, we have one conclusionary statement on Exclusion H before I move forward. The question of loss in Illinois is defined as the depletion of the bank's assets. The depletion results in this case specifically because this individual has engaged in false pretenses. Whether or not the bank policy was adhered to is not relevant because none of the case authority imposes a negligence standard based on a bank's own policies.
Those cases you cite about that aren't bank cases, though, are they?
Well, yes, in fact, the home indemnity case is a liability bond case. Now, as to our cross appeal, we've asked that the court overrule and reverse the ruling on our request for prejudgment interest. Under prejudgment interest in Illinois, it is a party is entitled, shall be awarded if the three requirements are met. It's an instrument of writing. A bond is specifically identified in the prejudgment interest statute. The amount at issue is subject to easy calculation, which in this case it is, $307,000 minus the $15,000 deductible, $292,000, very easily calculable, and they failed to pay when due. Now, the insurer, Ohio Casualty, makes an argument about there's no due date on this bond. It doesn't matter. Illinois courts, the reserve case that they cite, says there's an inherent due date when you tender the proof of loss. This court has previously held on two separate occasions that a bond like this, a banker's bond, is appropriate for the interest, for under prejudgment interest, and therefore should have been awarded in this case. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Schoenberger?
I just have two quick points to make, and then I'll wrap up. Addressing, I think the point was raised as to Exclusion H, what if the employee follows the policy to the letter? Well, under a direct proximate cause analysis, which is what the language requires, it still has to be a foreseeable result. So in that situation, maybe you follow the policy to the letter and something happens. Maybe that's not a foreseeable result. But in this case, we don't have that situation. We have a deliberate violation of policy. So I think that's maybe where the distinction in that situation lies. And then as to the cross-appeal, I think our argument is straightforward in the brief. They never raised this until the 59E motion. And those motions are only allowed to be granted where you can prove a misapplication of law or facts or a misinterpretation of law or facts. And that simply can't happen if you never raise the argument to begin with. And that's all we have. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. We will take this case under advisement.